Media Masters with Paul Blanchard.
Welcome to Media Masters, a series of one-to-one interviews with people at the top of the media game. Today I'm joined by Daniel Pearl, commissioning editor for Channel 5. Daniel has led the development of hundreds of hours of unscripted factual series, including Weekend Breaks with Greg Wallace, Our Yorkshire Farm and The Jeremy Vine Show. He previously spent 6 years at Channel 4, where he originated and commissioned the Michael Jackson documentary Leaving Neverland and oversaw their flagship current affairs show, Dispatches. He also spent over 10 years at the BBC, where he edited the 2010 prime ministerial election debate and was deputy editor on Panorama, Newsnight and the 6 and 10 o'clock news. Dan, thank you for joining me.
Thank you for inviting me.
An incredible CV already. I always start this podcast with imposter syndrome. Why have you achieved so much and me so little?
That's very kind of you to say. I'm very, very old.
No, but yeah, I mean, you're obviously a telly bloke to your bones.
I've been really lucky actually in TV, and I didn't set out to be in television. I sort of dropped into it. I actually started off in kind of management consultancy, which
wasn't glamorous enough.
Well, it was my first job out of university, and it was fun, but it wasn't what I really wanted to do. And I was really interested in politics at the time. And after about a year or so of that, I saw a little advert in the newspaper, I think in The Guardian, and I was one of a few people who actually got a job through an advert in the newspaper. I just applied for it out of the blue, and it was for a researcher in a political programme, and I got it.
Oh, which one was that?
It was. Now, you may not remember this. It was only on for a few weeks, and it was called Think Tank, and it was on Sundays, BBC One, back in the 90s, and I was the political researcher for that.
Was this after Frost's programme? How did it work?
It was a bit... over the summer... They had a separate political programme.
When Parliament was shut,
exactly,
you got Think Tank.
And I remember turning up and thinking, I know nothing about television. I'm a complete fraud. As a researcher, I was told what to do, and I kind of got on with it. And we had the idea behind it, if I remember rightly, was each week we had a subject. I haven't thought about this programme for a very long time. We had a subject, and we had experts, and they had very rudimentary graphics, and they tried to argue... It was all light rather than heat. Very, very 1990s, actually. And if I remember rightly, David Aronovich was the presenter. And
great
it lasted,
journalist.
I think he
sat in that chair.
He will remember this better than I did. The thing I remember most about it was that we didn't have any graphics. And so we had to use the laptops from the office to generate the graphics on air. So every Thursday, a man would come and collect all our computers from the office and take them down to the television centre to set them up for the TV graphics. And that's how they worked then. And so for 3 or 4 days, we had no computers.
I'd go back to that now. I mean, that sounds, you know, all this on-demand digital playout system, I mean, it seems to be a waste of time.
It was an eye-opener, but I really enjoyed it. I was there over the summer, and as a result of that...
You got the bug.
Well, the executive producer at the time was David Jordan. And he was also the editor of On the Record, and a really, really great guy. And so he liked me, and I managed to become a researcher on the Record, which was the John Humphreys-fronted Sunday political programme.
I loved On the Record.
With the crocodile.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes. Wow, that is a real blast from the past.
Yes, absolutely.
How long were you on the Record for?
On the Record, 3 years. As first a researcher and then a producer, assistant producer, and that's where I kind of learnt a little bit about television. Nearly all from David, actually, who is an absolutely brilliant journalist. And he came from that school of political journalism from LWT, I think, originally, where they took an interview and taught you how to break it down. And so we used to sit down and work out interviews between John Humphreys and John Major, Tony Blair, and all, and other people at the time. And we'd structure it like a barrister's brief. So and I was taught that there. So I remember we did the Bernie Eccleston interview with Tony Blair. I don't know if you remember back in 1997.
That was the first ever big scandal, wasn't it?
Right, yes.
The tobacco sponsorship of Formula One.
And so that was a strange one because... So I was a researcher. That was in 1997. He had just been Prime Minister for a few months, I think.
It was the first big scandal of the Labour government.
That's right. And we got a phone call on the Saturday. We were supposed to be interviewing Jack Cunningham. I don't know how I remember that, but Jack Cunningham. And on the Saturday, we took a phone call in the office. We're preparing the interview for Jack Cunningham, and we're going to ask him about the scandal. And on the phone was Alistair Campbell. And he said, his exact words were something along the lines of, I remember this, who are you interviewing tomorrow? And I think we said, Jack Cunningham, and he said, no, you're not. And we said, oh, no, we really are. We've got permission and everything. And he said, no, you're coming to Chequers and interviewing Tony Blair.
What was that like to go to Chequers?
I mean, presumably, I didn't go, actually.
Presumably, you said, well, look, Alistair, you know, we're not interested in the Prime Minister.
We just want
Jack Cunningham on. You know, our word is as good as our bond.
Yeah, we're sticking with Jack.
I was dumped by Wake Up to Money this morning, just in the editor. They got someone better on reputation at 5 a.m. I thought, thanks very much. But it is the nature of the beast, isn't it?
Yeah, no, I just remember. And that's actually probably that day was probably when I got the bug, because it was so exciting. And I was in my early 20s, probably. All of a sudden to be right at the heart of a major breaking story, which felt very, very important at that time. And John was very excited and the team was very excited. And we sat there and we went through the hour-long interview. I mean, an hour long. Imagine that now.
You wouldn't get that now. And was it live?
It was live.
It wasn't as live. It was literally live to air. Wow. Yeah. So you must have had some kind of huge satellite truck then in the garden at Chequers.
Well, some of the team went down to Chequers. I was back at Television Centre, so... I never went to Chequers.
Wow.
I've never been to Chequers.
Wow. But that was quite brave of them, wasn't it? Because they could have just put Jack on. I mean, nowadays, that's what someone would do. They put a junior member of the team on to say, well, it's not for me to say, whereas they went straight with, well, the Prime Minister will defend this.
Absolutely. And I think that you'd have to ask Alistair Campbell what was the thinking there. But looking back at it, there was a massive scandal. They genuinely felt that it was potentially an issue. And they felt the only way to deal with it was to properly deal with it and have a very, very...
Run toward the gunfire.
Exactly. Yeah. And we sat down there and all Saturday we rehearsed it. So again, as a junior researcher, I played Tony Blair, I played John Humphreys, and we went through it and we had a structure which said if he asked this, if he answers in this way, we ask this question.
Like a flowchart.
All the way through. And we used to use those all the time at On Record. That came from David and his team. So that was kind of the first real experience of being at in the middle of a really breaking news story. And I just remember seeing, and it was an incredible program. And the next day, every single front page of every newspaper had the picture of Tony Blair. Do you remember he had too much makeup on? They were worried, if I remember rightly, they were worried that he would look the whole Nixon issue.
Yeah.
And they put a lot of makeup on. And he ended up looking a little bit like a mannequin.
Yeah, like he was out with Dead or Alive or something, like Pete Burns.
But yes, that was back in 1997. So that was my first experience of television. Really, so.
And how much of it is, you know, the brief, and how much of it was John in the moment? Because, I mean, he's an experienced broadcaster and journalist in his own right. If the Prime Minister says something that's not on your script, he has to still go in there and follow up on that.
Absolutely. And I think that those political interviews, which used to go on for a long time, so quite often we didn't always have a whole hour, but we often had 20 minutes, 25 minutes. That was quite normal. Most Sundays we'd have 25 minutes to 30 minutes interviewing a senior member of a cabinet or shadow cabinet. And they were structured, but yes, of course, John would go off script and follow up and listen to the questions. And I think I do miss that, actually. I mean, you know, we have a lot of political programming on television, but we don't have many where you just sit and have the time to scrutinise a politician at that length.
But no one has any attention anymore anyway. I mean, even I don't. I can't even watch a film without sort of second screening going on IMDb and finding out who that actor is and what he was in before. And, you know, I am listening, but I'm on Twitter as well. And
But you say that, but then you might watch 10 hours of The Crown in one sitting.
I watch a lot of Channel 5. I'm going to get to that soon. I'm watching a series at the moment that you guys are showing about basically police officers getting punched in the face. I think it's called Code Zero or something. It's fantastic. But it's one of these shows that makes my blood boil because, as ever, you know, when anyone punches a police officer and they get them, I think that's great. And I'm looking forward to that end caption that says they got 8 years in prison and it says they got 180 quid fine and were bound over for 4 weeks.
It's unbelievable,
isn't it? Bound over
is.
But I'm thinking he's out on the streets.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's one of my programmes I'm making at the moment.
Wow. Well, we'll come to that. To be honest, we've got a lot. We've got between sort of On the Record to coppers getting punched in the face. There's a lot of ground to cover. So by this point then, you obviously knew how to put a political programme together yourself.
I mean, I was learning. I mean, it was. I mean, I was a researcher and I put in the hours to in terms of interviewing and briefs. And it was almost like being a kind of a junior barrister or I assume that's what it's like, because we used to work towards each Sunday's TV show, and each Sunday's TV show had a big major political interview at its heart. And we'd have 25 minutes, as I say, or half an hour for those interviews, and we'd spend a lot of time structuring it. Then after about a year or so, I started work out or that I wanted to make films as well. And we used to, it was an amazing experience because we were allowed to go away and make political films on pretty much any subject within the political world and be creative if we could. And so I learned a lot from the team around me then. But yeah, 3 years I spent there.
So what came next?
Then I went over to Newsnight as an assistant producer. And I spent 6 years, I think, at Newsnight.
Was it Kirsty and the two Jeremys at that point?
It was. It changed. We had, yes, it was Kirsty. It was both Jeremys. And it was Gavin.
Gavin, of course. I keep forgetting Gavin. Peter, yeah. Or was he long gone?
Peter Snow. No, I don't believe he was there. He wasn't there when I was there. But it was an amazing, that really was, I mean, they were 6 years, in some ways, the most fun 6 years I've had in my career. So
both Jeremys are really good, actually, in different ways.
Absolutely. I loved working with both of them and had a lot of really good times there. And I pretty much, over those 6 years, did pretty much every job. So I was on the desk, which is every day a few unlucky souls are asked to be on the desk as producers. And you come in at whatever time it is, I can't remember now, 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock. And there's a meeting, and then afterwards you're told what subject you're making a film about that night. And it could be anything, literally anything. And you start with zero knowledge. And by 10:30, you put a film on the telly.
As a total expert.
and you learn quickly, really quickly. So I did that. I was Evan Davis's producer, economics producer, and we travelled around the world a bit. I did some war producing. I was Martha Carney's producer for a year and a bit. During the 2001 election, which was fun. So I spent a lot of time with Martha. And then became program editor and did about 100-150 programs. And that probably was the best job I've ever had.
Editor of Newsnight?
The output editor. So the way it works, I assume it still works that way now, you'd be in charge of two programs a week. You'd do a bit of planning the day before, but frankly, you can't really plan for the news.
You can't.
So you'd come in...
Especially these days.
Yeah. Yeah. It must be hard now. But you'd come in relatively early, read all the newspapers, listen to the Today programme. You could be in by kind of 7:30.
That's a long shift.
Yeah, really long shift. And it was amazing because I was in my probably late 20s-ish. And you'd have a small team and you'd basically have 45 minutes of television that night that you have to put out on any subject. And it was up to you. And that was just so exciting. You'd come in and say, I mean, this... So I was doing that from 2003, I think.
Did you ever worry about getting it wrong? Because, I mean, that's quite a responsibility.
Yeah, I mean, there were other people as well. But yeah, no, it was more... It wasn't about getting it wrong. It was about choosing the right subjects. And we were... I mean, George Entwistle was the editor at the time. And he was brilliant and would really encourage us to try things. And... It was a really exciting place to be. There was a brilliant team. There's a lot going on in the world because it was right up into the lead up of the Iraq War and then the aftermath of the Iraq War.
Mm.
David Kelly, all that period.
Did you ever have the problem where there was too much to put in the programme and you were trying to sort of work out what you had to cut back?
Yeah, often. I mean, the point then, and I'm sure it's the same now, is that we didn't have to be the news. The news was the news. And it had to decide what was the most important subjects of that day in the right order. Whereas for Newsnight, then and now, and I think Newsnight's excellent at the moment, really excellent, it was about finding interesting things to discuss. And I used to think that if I find this interesting, I'll put it on the telly. Wow. And we used to come in the morning and sometimes there'd be something in the paper, maybe somewhere, a nib somewhere in the paper, and you think, that's really interesting, I'm going to do a piece on it. And that happened a few times, not often, but a few times you used to go, I'm interested in that, I'm putting it on the telly tonight. And that's incredible, it's a privilege, but it was really fun.
And did you already know by then that you didn't want to be airside? When I had Jeremy Vine sitting in that chair, he said that he has the show-off gene and that some people... It's very rare that you get someone like Nick Robinson that comes through up the producer ranks and then goes airside. People decide fairly early on whether they want that attention or not.
I think I did know. I enjoyed being in the gallery. I enjoyed... I mean, it was nerve-wracking, but I enjoyed the pressure of that. Yeah, and I enjoyed making those decisions. It was. I mean, I was never kind of into theatre or personally on stage, so... Mm. So, yes, no, I think I always knew that I enjoyed more the editorial side of things.
What came after Newsnight?
So I was at Newsnight, then I became deputy editor at Newsnight with Peter Barron, who was absolutely brilliant boss.
Another person who sat in that chair.
Has he? Okay.
Yeah, he's basically retired now, hasn't he? He's left Google and he's now in his villa.
Living in Spain.
Yeah, he's doing well, good on him.
He taught me huge amounts.
I've had a lot of time for Peter over the years.
Yeah, I mean, he did a couple of things. It's funny. I've been really, really lucky to have some great bosses with George and David Jordan, as I say, Peter Barron. And Peter Barron, the couple of things that I always held on to, he came in and said, anyone can have a good idea. And we used to have these meetings where every single person in the team would come, and whoever came up with the good idea would make that program or that item. And that would be a junior person. It might be a really junior person who's only just turned up, an intern. And some of the best ideas we had on the program during that kind of fun, very fun period, 2005-ish, came from anywhere in the team. And you know, that's a lesson for everyone. Creativity doesn't necessarily come from the top, almost never does. And when during that period we had the whole, I don't know if you remember that Jeremy Paxman reading the weather.
I don't remember.
Do you remember
it,
that?
No.
For a bit, he used to do the markets.
Oh, yes, he did. That was right. He read it from the chair, didn't he?
Someone came up with a bright idea. Why are we doing the markets? No, who cares what the pound has gone up or whatever? And it was always a thing that everyone thought of right at the last when you're putting the programme together. So it was always wrong. And I just, like, 9 out of 10 times, the markets were wrong. The pound, we got the pound went up when it actually went down, or vice versa. So we said, let's do the weather. Everyone cares about the weather. And then Jeremy, obviously, if you look, see it on YouTube.
Yeah, he just sneered his way through it, didn't he?
It was very funny.
So who cares?
Yeah. I think the best one was something along the lines of, and now the weather, stick your head out the window, take a look or something.
Yeah, exactly.
Tomorrow you'll need an umbrella. But then in 2006, I went over to join Craig Oliver as his deputy on the 6 and 10, which was a very different beast, really, going from Newsnight to the main grown-up bulletins on BBC One.
Well, the 6 and 10 are obviously the flagship shows. I mean, you know, I saw you recently with Paul Royal, who's the current editor of the 6 and 10. I mean, that's where the, you know, all the top talent in the BBC, they're anchored to those shows. You know, Laura Koonsberg is political editor of the whole BBC, but really she answers to the 6 and 10.
It was a very different type of job, actually. Both the scrutiny was much more than you'd get at Newsnight, but the ability to influence things. And we used to have this, I'm sure Paul still does, but the idea of, we used to have this line about the power of a 10. So people used to say, what's the, you know, as the editor or the deputy editor of the 10 o'clock news, when we worked out or decided or came upon the running order, that was the news, that was the running order. That's how it felt at the time. I don't know if it does. You have to ask Paul how it feels now. But to some extent, it led the way. You'd make the running order, and you'd see the rest of the BBC News falling in, you know, looking at what you were doing. And so there's a lot of responsibility on making those decisions. And there were some big calls during that period, some really big calls. I mean, I happened to be in the seat when Robert Peston broke the Northern Rock story.
Mm.
That was a big
evening. It was huge. I mean, it's still pretty huge now, isn't it?
It was a big evening, yes. So the story there was Robert, obviously, found out through his sources that something was afoot. And I was overseeing the 10 o'clock news that night, and I got a call from my then boss, Peter Horrocks, to say that Robert was going to call me. He'd got a really good story. And this was quite late, around 6 o'clock at night. It was after 6 o'clock news. So we were already, you know, had the running order for the 10 ready to go. Might have even been a bit later. So Robert called me. And he hadn't been at the BBC that long, I don't think, then. Maybe 6 months to a year. I have to check that. And he said he's got a great story. And he started telling me on the phone what this story was. And I can say it now because it's over 10 years ago. I had no idea what he was talking about. We hadn't, looking back, you know, we hadn't hardly covered any banking crisis. And I wasn't a banking expert by any means. And I didn't understand what all those things he was saying meant. So I said, come in. And he got in a taxi, and then he phoned me about half an hour later from the taxi, and they were driving the wrong way up the A40 towards Oxford, and so I had to speak to his cab driver to turn around and come back to Television Centre. Meanwhile, he was explaining to me Northern Rock and this whole business about the loans, and we were trying slowly to put together a piece, but I, to be honest, didn't understand it. And finally he came in and we sat down and we discussed the subject, and I still didn't understand it. I was a bit stupid. And it must have been really frustrating to Robert, who just looked at me. And eventually I said to him, "Is it so I get this? Where does it go in the running order?" And he just looked at me and exploded, rightly so, and just said, "Look, this is the biggest story I've ever had in my life. It's the lead story." I mean, at that point I was thinking, where do I put it?
Yeah.
Second or third? I don't know. And to explain just how far we were removed from the banking crisis at that time. We didn't even have it in the graphics team at the BBC, the whole BBC. We didn't even have an up-to-date graphic for Northern Rock. We had their old logo. And if I remember rightly, the piece, if everyone goes back and has a look at the piece on that night, we ripped it off the internet, I think. The kind of nascent internet at the time.
But did you have time to put together a package and then have him in the studio?
Because we did, yes. Just.
Wow.
It was close. But yes.
And the effects were incredibly far-reaching, of course, because there were queues a mile long the very next day, weren't there?
And it finally got through to me about, it must have been 9:30-ish on that night when I was trying to work out where in the running order it went. I'm quite embarrassed now thinking about it. And Robert just blew up and said, Northern Rock's going bust or something like that. And it suddenly struck me. I understood it at that last moment. I understood there's a bank going bust and everyone's going to run down and try and get their money out. And I remember ringing Gavin Hewitt, who was our special correspondent at home, and saying, tomorrow morning you get up really early and go to the nearest Northern Rock branch because there'll be queues. And we suddenly realised the magnitude of the story that we were breaking, or that Robert was breaking. And that was quite a pivotal moment, actually.
What came next then, after the 6 and 10?
So after the 6 and 10, I really enjoyed the news and the immediacy of it, but I wanted, at that point, I thought it would be fun to go into longer form television and journalism. And I was really lucky and got a job as deputy editor on Panorama with the then editor of Panorama, Sandy Smith.
We've had Rachel Jupp on, actually. She was brilliant.
Brilliant. Yeah. She's a very successful editor now.
How long were you at Panorama for?
A few years. And Tom Giles then took over Sandy as the editor, so I was his deputy. And that was 2009 through to 2012.
Now, that must have been amazing, because I'd love to be a fly on the wall in those secret meetings where you... Because, of course, no one else in BBC News knows what you're going to cover. It's completely closed door, isn't it?
Yeah, it was really, really fun. And Tom, the editor who's now head of current affairs at ITV, was an absolutely outstanding editor. I mean, absolutely brilliant and very, very brave. And looking back at that period, especially 2011... I think it was 11, when we were doing all sorts of amazing investigations across the team, including the FA, the Blatter investigations at the time when the FA were bidding for the World Cup. And so there was a huge amount of pressure on the BBC at the time in terms of that investigation.
Yeah, not to reveal that it was a lot of wrong-uns.
I won't go over all that. And they had Winterbourne View as well was that year.
Wow.
So there was a lot of, it was an amazing period. And John Ware, John Sweeney, Paul Kenyon, and many, many others.
We've had John on. I mean, he's a legend. I've been friends with John Sweeney for many, many years.
John's great fun. And we...
I love that clip of him on YouTube where he's shouting at Mike Rinder, the Scientologist.
And
they're friends now. They're friends now. And I remember watching it at the time thinking, credit to you that you had to leave it in, because, of course, the Scientologists had already had their version of it online. It wouldn't be fair journalism if you didn't put it in. But, I mean, I think even on John's Twitter handle now, it says John Sweeney Raw.
Bless As him. He says, I apologise then and I apologise now.
Yeah,
he often says that when you meet him as well.
Yeah, he does.
Just in case.
He does.
But yes, that was fun. We did lots of films with John. I did one about begging. Child Beggars, I think it was, in London, which was on BBC One. And he tracked down the families who were then begging in London, and he followed them back to their houses, and then we got hold of we found their cars and we traced them back to their houses in Romania. And he went out to the houses in Romania where the kind of organised crime families were living. Again, I think this is probably on YouTube. He got confronted by a rather old lady with a very big stone who ran him up and down the street in Romania and threatened to hit him over the head with a stone. And
I do remember
It's worth
that.
Watching.
He reminded me at the time of... Roger Cook. Do you remember Roger used to sort of knock on the door of some absolute rogue, some mafia guy, and say, you're a mafia killer, aren't you? And I'm thinking, God, that took some stones, I think.
Absolutely.
So how long were you at Panorama for?
It was just over 2 years, I think, two and a half years.
And then was there a natural break point where you felt it was time to move on, or did the next opportunities kind of semi-fall in your lap?
I think it's about making your own opportunities to some extent, but there's a lot of luck involved. And I've been lucky to meet people along the way, and then people... So I knew Sandy before the Panorama job came up. I went from BBC to Channel 4. Jay Hunt had taken over at Channel 4, been there for a year or so, and I knew her from the BBC. And so I contacted her and said, love to apply for this job. And so that's sort of, so it's a bit of, I think it's a bit of both, isn't it? It's quite a lot of luck in all of these things, really. I was lucky, just before I left, I was lucky enough to work on the 2010 election debate, the Prime Minister election debate as well. So, I mean, I felt like that was a, although it took a, it was in 2010, that was the kind of, in my mind, the thing I really wanted to do. And after that, I was ready to leave the BBC after many years.
How do you edit a show like that? Because, you know, there's all the security logistics. And I mean, ultimately, though, isn't it about, you know, and not to demean the job, you're about to correct me, but isn't it just about sort of sticking the leaders of the parties in a podium with a representative audience and then letting whoever was the anchor get on with it?
It was David Dimbleby. Back then, I think that's probably the way, if I thought about it now, it is that back then it didn't feel like that because it had never been done before. So we started with an absolute blank sheet of paper. And there were many, many rules that people had written down. Andy Coulson mostly had written down. But we really started from there. So we had to decide where it was going to be. And that actually took quite a long time. We had to decide what location it would be in, what it was going to look like, the podiums. Every little detail had never been decided before or discussed before. And so many times they had come close to having these debates and never had them. So there was always a threat or this lingering doubt, would it actually happen? Would it actually happen until the ITV debate finally happened? So there was a lot to think about. And although in some ways it was a very simple program, obviously very simple, the pressure around it and the fact that it was so high profile, we knew, you know, many millions of people, I think it was 9 million people were going to watch. We had the whole of the world's press. We were in Birmingham University and we set up a whole spin room for them. I think there were 250-odd journalists watching there, writing every word.
Yeah, because like Sky were doing live from the spin room, even though it was a BBC show, they were like, you're covering, because it was such a big story.
It felt like we were arranging like a wedding or an event of, you know, it wasn't just a TV program. There were all these other bits around it. Where would the audience go? How would the audience be vetted? How would they get from where they were being penned into the set? They were in a bus, and what would happen to them afterwards? And we had Question Time came from the same, from a couple of buildings down on site. Where would the leaders be? So on that one, we found these, we were in Birmingham University, and they had these beautiful rooms, three rooms next to each other, right next down the corridor. One was the Vice Chancellor's office, might be that, or the Proctor's office. And we had to decide, where does Gordon Brown go? Where does David Cameron go? Actually, that's a funny story, because we finally sitting in the scanner waiting to go to air. We had about 10 minutes to go, I think. It was calm. And we couldn't find the Prime Minister, who was Gordon Brown and at the time. And we said, well, the runner went down to go and get him to come back to the set. And I got the message that he was locked in the room. And this is a true story. Apparently, the handle had come off the door and locked him in. Someone, I don't know who, had ferociously pulled at the handle and the handle come off. Anyway, so we had to get...
It had been Gordon in a temper.
I wasn't there, so I can say. Anyway, the next day, I gave the handle of the door to the Vice-Chancellor of Birmingham University. He said he'd put it on his desk.
What, as a memento, to as evidence of the prime ministerial rage? Wow. But you felt that it was time to move on from the BBC at that point?
From the BBC, yes. Well, the opportunity came at Channel 4, and it was editor of dispatches, which was...
So this is the first job in the top chair, is that right?
It was the first time I'd had an opportunity to edit something beyond the debate, which was a single programme. And I'd been really lucky in being deputy to some amazingly inspirational people. But being the editor is a different perspective. And that I really, really wanted. I felt ready to do it, and I really wanted to do it.
How is it a different perspective?
In the end, you make decisions. And I was really lucky to have a great, amazing team. And I was deputy to Dorothy Byrne, who's my boss and will always be my boss. But in terms of the programme itself, we had, you know, 30, 40 programmes a year, investigations, high-profile investigations.
Or Plebgate, the Stephen Lawrence undercover policing scandal. That led to a full public inquiry.
Yes, that was an amazing film, which came about largely from the journalism of The Guardian, actually, and we worked with them. And the public inquiry, I don't think it's ever actually come to an end as far as I can see. But that was the Stephen Lawrence, the news that the police had been spying on Stephen Lawrence's family at the time when they should have been investigating or finding his murderer.
Well, indeed. And you were 6 years at Channel 4?
6 years, yes.
And you commissioned, you originated and commissioned the Michael Jackson documentary.
Yeah, the great thing about Channel 4 was that although I had my own strand in terms of dispatches, which was amazing, we were also able to be self-generating in terms of ideas. There was a really, really amazing team around us. And Jay, as the boss, was very, very encouraging in terms of coming up with new ideas and thoughts. And the Michael Jackson one was many years in discussion. And that came about largely by Dan Reed, the director, who I knew him from before, and we had often discussed ideas and been meeting up to try and discuss projects for Channel 4. He'd been making quite a few films for the BBC. He's an amazing director. And I think it was the second or third time we sat down, and there were two things that came to the Michael Jackson. First was, it was quite obvious that a lot of the best journalism is in plain sight. And that's, we had this whole discussion about journalism in plain sight and how in some ways the whole Watergate scandal in a way has kind of warped journalism, because people think that all the best stories are, you know, deep throat in a,
yeah,
in a garage. Wooden
Bernstein.
And all the rest of it. And that somehow there's some great big conspiracy. Whereas actually when we look at the big stories that people report, they tend to be things that we sort of knew. That generated a kind of discussion we were having. And it struck me, and it always struck me a little bit around following on from Jimmy Savile and some of the other sex scandals at the time.
Enough children had accused Michael Jackson of being a pedophile, or paedophile, as we would say.
Yeah, and even just on the basis of what we know, he's an adult man, a married adult man with children, so sexually active adult man, who has openly admitted to spending hours and hours and hours and hours in the bed of unsupervised of young children.
Well, the Jackson family don't deny that he had a child in his bed almost every night, and there was a series of interlocking doors, each one with a bell, just for people to even get to his bedroom, where he's there with a child alone.
That's all. No one disputes any of that.
That is so... Why is that not, you know...
And in addition to that, a number of people have come out and accused him of sexually abusing them.
Well, Jordy Chandler, Gavin Aviso, all of these people.
Yeah, I mean, and two more in terms of the film.
I believe them because they admitted that they lied at the original trial, because that's the kind of behaviour that you often get of victims of sexual violence.
I mean, the way the story came about is that I gave Dan a little bit of our development money to go and do some work on Michael Jackson. He had said to me, is there a story you're really, really interested in? And Michael, I'd always been interested in Michael Jackson, partly because I always loved Michael Jackson's music.
Me too, although I won't listen to it anymore.
I'm still torn by that, actually. My view is you can't... His music's still great. And many other people contributed to his music as well. And
it's the whole, can you separate an artist from their art?
I think you just have to be honest. I think there'll come a moment where we can listen to Michael Jackson music again. But as long as we accept, in my mind, we accept that he was a predatory paedophile, and I think it's difficult to get away from that fact. At the moment, it doesn't feel right, but I think at some point in the future, it could feel right again to listen to his music in the knowledge that he was not a nice person. There was nothing nice about him. But yes, it's difficult. But anyway, Dan came back with, he found out that there was these court cases going on, and we sent him out. Dan went out to America to meet the lawyers of the two, and came back a few weeks later after some back and fro with the interviews. So very, very early on in the process, we had the two central interviews already recorded. And I remember sitting and Dan cut together about 30 minutes of these two interviews. And I remember watching them, and there is nothing in them. I mean, there is no way you can't believe them.
They're telling
the
truth.
Incredible interviews I've ever seen.
Me too. I watched it. I watched it with an open mind, thinking, you know, he could be a paedophile, but he might not be, and I'll give him the fair crack of the whip. And I genuinely went into that documentary watching that with an open mind, prepared to thinking, well, they could be trying it on, they might not be. I watched it. There was no doubt in my mind at the end of it. I believe them.
To not believe them and to believe that somehow Michael Jackson wasn't a paedophile is such a leap of faith. It's so far out there for any reasonable human being to believe that this man who admits to sleeping with unsupervised for months and months and months with young boys, and who is regularly accused of sexually abusing them, and whose victims are so credible in so many ways, for him not to be a paedophile is incredible for me.
Literally.
Yeah.
But that must have taken genuine courage, because as you were saying that, I was reminded of what you said about Newsnight when you were looking at Nibs and so on, where you know the genesis of the actually picking that to be of interest came from you. You must be incredibly proud of that.
I mean, it's Dan's film, very much Dan's film, and he put his heart and soul into that program. But one of the incredible strengths of a career like mine or in journalism is the ability to see things and to identify things that you might be interested, you might read, you might get from anywhere, newspapers or anywhere, and then somehow turn it from a thought into a television program which actually people watch. It's just such a privilege. I mean, that's probably the bit I enjoy most in television.
But what you must have been aware, even at the time when you commissioned it or gave him the seed money of the blowback, I mean, you're dealing with an institution. There's the corporate lawsuits. You know, the Jackson estate is very, very wealthy. But then you've also got the millions of fans. I mean, you kind of really, you're really challenging the notions of... I mean that actually interests me. I mean, how, you know, what kind of feedback did you get? Did many people like me change their mind or come to a conclusion?
I mean, that's difficult to say. I mean, I think the Michael Jackson fans are adamant and very, very vociferous, and you can go online and see all their comments about minutiae here and minutiae there, which somehow disproves the point.
Well, tell us about Channel 5 then, because your role extends from like documentaries examining social housing in Britain after Grenfell to, like, obviously the Jeremy Vine show.
Yeah, so after a really good time at Channel 4, I thought... I love television. I love the industry of television, the business of TV. And I'd always been in the current affairs and more factual areas. And I really wanted to challenge myself away from those kind of programmes to trying something much more commercial, where you're judged more commercially. You're judged very much by numbers. And also the opportunity to try different types of television, and the Channel 5 commissioner job came up, and it's given me all those opportunities. The Jeremy Vine program is kind of, it's been such fun.
I like Jeremy. I always have.
Did he do a podcast?
Yeah, he did it years ago. Yeah. In fact, Jeremy, to his credit, I used to go on his show an awful lot when I was working in London largely, and I was sort of, you know, pop up, gob on a stick. I'd talk about anything, so I was kind of pals with him. And he was one of the earliest people that actually did Media Masters that generated quite an audience, because I think he'd just done Strictly or was about to do it or something, but it generated sort of dozens of thousands of new listeners. I'm always very grateful to him for that.
But he's got that very rare ability to be able to be serious and be lighthearted.
The old light and shade.
Absolutely. And so the story there was I joined Channel 5, and not long after, I was part of my slate was the Matthew Wright, the Wright stuff. And almost within days of that becoming part of my slate, Matthew resigned. And we talked, and he was adamant he wanted to leave. So it was quite clear that I needed to find a replacement. And that was a big issue for us. I mean, Channel 5, I mean, the Wright stuff had been on air for 18 years and was every 2 hours every morning. It was a big chunk of the schedule. And replacing Matthew and finding who would fit that role, but also change the program and create a program in that we were proud of.
But also it's about creating a dynamic on screen, isn't it? Because Jeremy, when he did his Radio 2 show, was just there on his own. Whereas, you know, what elements do you bring over from Matthew's show? Obviously, Storm Huntley stayed on. How did that work?
Yes, well, I mean, the thing I've learned is it's a daytime show, which is a real privilege. So we thought about this a lot. I mean, what is it about a daytime show? Why are you watching a daytime show between 9:15 and 11:15? And that, in a way, is you've been allowed into someone's life. Now, if you're watching television at that time, there may be many reasons. It may be that you're looking after your kids, you're retired, you're on a maternity leave. There are many reasons that you may be home at that time, but you've decided, there's a lot of distractions out there in the world. You could go out, you could walk the dog, but you've decided to watch television. And it's very much about that it's about company. It's about almost like a club. And so what we've tried to do, and Jeremy has has really successfully done, and the audience figures are proving him right. He's created a real sense of a club. So Storm's role and the audience's role and the people who ring in every day, the same people.
And you record it back to front, don't you? Because you do the second hour first. So he can jet off to Wogan House on his bike and get run over or have endless altercations with taxi drivers, which he then puts on YouTube.
Well, we've never denied this, but we've never really discussed it either. But we there's a logistical issue in ensuring that he is at the BBC in time to record his trail with Ken Briggs.
I like the fact that you've descended into very carefully worded corporate speak there.
I can tell you, actually. I don't mind. So to make it work, so I was absolutely adamant that Jeremy was the right person for the job, and obviously he's on air every day on Radio 2.
He is.
And that created an issue, but we worked around it. We came up with a creative solution where the last 40 minutes, roughly, 35, 40 minutes of the programme is the newspaper review. And we can record that because it doesn't have any phone-ins. So we record that between around 8.15 to 8.45, and then we go live at 9.15.
And has it ever caught you out, even once or twice, where something was broken, you know, in that 45 minutes?
Not yet. I'm going to touch wood.
Right. God. Well, fair enough. Well, to be fair, it happens on a lot of shows. I mean, I listened to Up All Night on 5 Live, and Rod Sharp, who, of course, is an institution and a legend, broadcasts the show from Marblehead, Massachusetts, from his home. And again, he never says that on air, but it's not denied. Everyone knows it. It's part of the club. He always says, if you know it, then you're part of the club.
Well, I mean, it works. And for me, it was a price massively worth paying for Jeremy, who's been absolutely brilliant. And the program has built on Matthew's success and is up double figures now this year. So I'm very pleased about it.
And you're able to be bold. I mean, the new hate crime documentary uses uncensored footage of like abusive and racist language and behaviours on the streets of Britain. And as I say, the other documentary I was telling you about at the beginning of the podcast, the one where the violence showed against our police force is just unbelievable.
Yeah, that the Code Zero.
Love Code Zero. Yeah. I'm on about episode 4 now, season 1.
So the second season, second series comes back next year.
Episode 2, where it was set in the rural area, and it was at night, and that poor police officer, there was a man and a woman, and that man just turned like an animal and started, I mean, he basically tried to kill them.
It's upsetting.
Yeah, it was. I was genuinely upset. My wife was in tears, and I welled up as well, and he got like 2 years.
What that shows me is a couple of things. One is about heroes. And those people are real heroes, but
yeah,
also
they
that they're increasingly they're filming this stuff themselves. They have to, so the material exists. And we've basically on that program we slowed down the stories, so we just slowed. So rather than having bish bash bosh, lots and lots of clips,
it's like 3 an hour, isn't it?
Yeah, we slowed it right down to 3 an hour, so we could tell the stories properly and the impact on the individuals properly, and it was very impactful. In fact, I think it was the highest 10 o'clock series we had in 2019. So people
has to be after the watershed, of course, because it's the poor coppers are getting punched in the face.
And as you say, it's the feedback we got was really shocking around the sentencing and the lack of sentencing as well.
And just how grateful we should be to our, you know the police, because they put themselves, it's almost a cliche, but putting themselves in harm's way every day, but they really do. And you know, one of the things that really struck me is a routine traffic stop of someone on a motorbike can turn into an attempted murder situation.
Yes, and I think that happens increasingly often. I mean, they say every 6 minutes they press the Code Zero button or some statistic like that, which is quite incredible. So, I mean, I think that what I've tried to do a little bit with Channel 5 is I've got current affairs background, as we've discussed, so it's where can we find current topical stories, which could be done in a more traditional panorama dispatchers-y way, but in Channel 5 in a broader factual space, how can we take that the topicality of that story and tell it in a more factual way?
Because you commissioned 200 hours of peak time shows. I mean, that's a lot of airtime.
So Channel 5 is a strange beast. There are only 8 commissioners. And so in comparison to, say, Channel 4, I think there are around 44 commissioners.
Incredible.
Roughly, may have changed.
Well, that's the commercial reality of life today, isn't it?
So we have 8 commissioners. So we have more hours, obviously, but we do have long series. What it means is that we have to behave slightly differently from the way that you would work at Channel 4 or the BBC.
I'd like to pitch a show to you. What about a series of one-to-one media interviews where a really good-looking and charismatic host takes someone in the media and chats to them for about an hour?
Have you pitched this before?
No. all right, I have multiple times now. I'm kidding. No. I think this might work as a podcast, but I doubt it would work as...
It would be like Brexit cast. You should film it.
I mean, to be fair, that has worked. The problem with filming it, we have done this with other clients, is no one actually is prepared to do the bandwidth, you know. I mean, because...
With the headphones, I don't understand Brexit cast. Why are they wearing headphones?
I don't know.
Because they don't need them.
I think it's to reinforce the fact that it's a podcast first. Oh. That just happens to be televised, and they're trying to keep
the cameras that accidentally wandered into the studio.
I think what they're trying to do is, because you'll know this yourself as well, is that if you take a radio show and just put cameras in, it can add to it. But if you make it into a television program, you have to change everything, and I think they just don't want to do that.
It's very good.
Yeah, it is. It's very, very good. And are you looking at things like that, where, you know, that might be new ways of doing shows where you would televise podcasts? Obviously, I'm not hawking my own at the moment.
Well, there's one particular one we're really interested in. I don't know if we are, really.
This whole thing's been a waste of time, then. I'm glad the record button wasn't pressed. What's next for you?
For me personally?
Yeah.
I don't really plan in that way. I don't know. I mean, as I say, I love television. I love the business of television. I think it's such an interesting industry, especially at the moment. I was thinking about this morning, and there can't be that many industries where technology is changing in the way that it is changing so dramatically. The way that people are consuming television is changing so dramatically. The businesses around the world are consolidating and transforming themselves rapidly. If we had this discussion 2 years ago, it would be a completely different world, television world out there. But people are still really love the content. So the content is still really, really strong. And the ideas behind the content and the production behind the content is really, really strong. People are desperate. People are seeking out ways of watching that content. But it's the technology and the business structures around it are changing. And I think that puts the industry set at a really interesting moment, and maybe more so than many, many other sectors.
Dan, you're a legend. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
A Right Angles podcast in association with Big Things Media.